Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. William Jefferson Clinton orchestrated a grand dedication for his presidential center in Little Rock today. It was an event he started planning while still in the White House. In remarks to some 30,000 people gathered there, he told them how he would like history to remember his administration.
I like the slogan we had way back in 1992, putting people first. Because in the end, I always kept score by a simple measure. Were ordinary people better off when I stopped than when I started?
But with those words and the official opening of the William J. Clinton Presidential Center, the former president has less control than ever over his legacy. It still remains to be seen how the public and scholars will interpret the millions of records, photographs, and memorabilia stored there. Tonight on Point, leadership and legacies. How will we remember the man from Hope? Was he a uniting figure or a polarizing one? How would you describe Clinton's legacy, or is it just too soon to tell? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Little Rock is Eleanor Clift, contributing editor for Newsweek magazine. Eleanor, welcome.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for being with us. I know it's been a long and busy day. And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Gail. Hello, Eleanor.
Hi.
Eleanor, I know it was something of a soggy dedication. Did it feel more solemn or celebratory to you?
Well, I think it was far more celebratory than it was sober or somber, although the concern about the rain seemed to dominate everything. And there was an assumption that the clouds would part and the rain would stop, surely, when President Clinton came out on the stage. But even Clinton couldn't control the weather. But Al Gore, in a luncheon after the ceremony, said, "Don't worry about the rain. 30 years ago, it rained at Woodstock, and they're still talking about the concert." So what was especially nice was the speeches from all four presidents, and it was a rare moment of generosity and friendship across the parties.
And how do you think Clinton looked? Because, of course, he's still recovering from quadruple bypass. It's certainly a thinner president than the one we got accustomed to seeing.
Yeah, I think he looks frailer, certainly, than we remember him. But he still has the smile and the energy and the optimism. And you get the feeling that he could have stayed standing there in the rain a lot longer and just continued speaking. He was really in his element. And the prospect that Hillary Clinton could run for president in 2008, I think, has energized the Democrats gathered here, even though there are apprehensions about whether she's really the right candidate. But there is a sense that all was not lost on Election Day, and that with President Clinton to guide them out of the wilderness, they may make it the next time.
Now, I understand that you have actually been through the Presidential Center. You have seen the exhibits. What do you think?
It is spectacular, and it's a futuristic building. It's this rectangular that the locals say looks like a double-wide trailer on stilts.
Hanging out over the river.
Yes, but it stops just at the river because the Secret Service wouldn't allow it to go any further. I don't quite know why, but that was the rule. But the architecture critics love it. They say it's a building for the ages, and it's distinctive. And it is bathed in light and lots of glass and transparent. And as the president said, he wanted this transparency. And in a way, it's a metaphor for his presidency and his personal life, which I think became perhaps a bit more transparent than he would have liked. But it's interactive. It's very well-designed with all the high moments of his presidency, from expanding trade to impeachment. And so there's plenty there for scholars, and there's also plenty for school kids to engage with. There's a humor section which has a video that he made during his final days in office, sort of laughing at the fact that he would have nothing to do, and he's chasing after Hillary, carrying her lunch. So it's very well done, and I think it sets a new standard for presidential libraries. I imagine President Bush has probably been taking notes about what to do when it's his turn.
Mm. Well, in fact, some of the items there include the sunglasses that Clinton wore when he played saxophone on the Arsenio Hall show in 1992. Sounds as if they really did make an effort to make it a lively and interesting reflection of the man, as well as the job he does.
Yeah, it's a living history, and I guess maybe it strikes me that especially that way because I lived through so much of this, and when you see contemporary events in your own mind now in a museum, you want them to be more alive than dead, and I think that's what this museum accomplishes.
Well, and so much of this, as you say, really is about perspective. Did you feel that there was a fair attempt made at balance in the exhibits?
Yes. I mean, there is an alcove devoted to impeachment, and it does frame it as the politics of persecution. And it talks about the intense partisanship of the 90s, and that by 1998 there were 7 independent counsels investigating various aspects of the Clinton presidency, spending $100 million, and that Ken Starr, who investigated Whitewater, which expanded into Monica Lewinsky, spent $70 million. And John Podesta, who was the president's former chief of staff and who was on the Content Advisory Committee, was asked whether this was a fair portrayal. And he said, look, this is our assessment, and if Ken Starr does his library someday, I'm sure he'll have a different perspective. But I think it is up to the scholars and the public that go through there to decide whether that was an appropriate expenditure of time and money on the part of the president's critics. And by the way, the critics don't let up. There's the same group that pursued then-Governor Clinton and President Clinton is planning a counter-library here in Little Rock with a satellite office in Washington. And so the Clinton wars continue.
A counter-library. And how big is that going to be?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it may just, let's hope it's just a dream or a nightmare. But there is talk about that. There's no way they're going to match what the president has done. I think the Clinton Library, the total comes to like $183 million, all raised privately, of course. And that dwarfs any of the previous libraries. And this is the 12th presidential library.
Now, this is also the first time a presidential library has featured a replica of the Oval Office, down to the most minute detail, apparently. Do you think that's going to be a big draw? Do people seem to be particularly fascinated by that today?
I think, you know, that's fun to look at, but more interesting is the cabinet room, where you can actually go in and sit at a cabinet chair, and then there's a computer screen there, and you can punch in whoever biography you want to read more about, or you can learn more about the events. I think that's, again, more interactive. But the Oval Office is amazingly exactly like the one in Washington. The Kennedy desk, which is very intricate woodwork, it's a wonderful replica. And on the mantelpiece is ivy that was grown from clippings taken from the ivy that was in the Oval Office when President Clinton was there. So they've tried to be faithful, and the paintings are reproduced. Amazing amount of workmanship and care went into reproducing the Oval Office. I wonder, I don't know this, but I wonder if President Clinton has gone to sit in the chair and maybe remember some of the high moments. The other thing is there's a moon rock on the coffee table, and one of the president's aides said that when they would be in there during contentious moments, he would point to the moon rock and say, you know, that's billions of years old. You know, surely we can resolve this. We're just passing through. And that was something that gave him a great deal of solace.
Certainly, I have a great vision of a photo op of him sitting behind the desk one more time.
Yes.
I understand there are also 2 emails that he sent while in office. Only 2? What were they?
I don't know what they were, but he was not computer literate at all. But when you go into the library, there is a scorecard. And as he said, he liked to keep score. Were ordinary people doing better? And so the number of people who came out of poverty and number of countries that have, are democratic. He's got all of those indices, but he does have one about the number of web pages. When he came into office, I think it was something like 223, and when he left, it was, I think, if it wasn't in the millions, it might even be in the billions. I mean, the Internet really exploded under his watch, but so did the number of AIDS cases. That's another dramatic number. There were, I think, like a million or so AIDS cases when he first took office, and it's 36 million when he left. So not just in this country, worldwide.
As you walk through, do you get the sense that this is more for the public or more for scholars, or is it truly balanced between those two interests?
Oh, I think it's both. I mean, it's they're almost arrows to toyland for young people with the copy describing the exhibits. There's actually sections that are highlighted. So if you just want to read the highlighted section, you can do that. It's sort of, you know, like a quick guide. Then you could, or you can read the whole section. And then there are boxes to be pulled out with more, you know, papers that the scholars will have access to. And the president has asked to have his papers released earlier than is required by law. And his speeches are throughout, and you can see how he annotated all his speeches, you know, with various remarks and changing things. This is a man who was very engaged in his job, and that really comes through.
And I have to say, I did chuckle at the idea that there is an area there for picnics and cookouts.
And there's going to be a children's park, which is under construction, where they're going to take the toys of his childhood, which I guess were trains and blocks, and blow them up into large sculptures, but, you know, for a children's area. And there's also room for him to be interred, if he so chooses. So it's an extraordinary development for Little Rock, and indeed for the whole region. And they're pointing out that Graceland is 2.5 hours away in Memphis, and Graceland gets 600,000 visitors a year, a third of them international. And so this whole complex, if it is the draw that Clinton surely hopes it will be, it could invigorate this whole area economically. And so a lot of the locals who don't like Clinton, because that same intensity is here as in the rest of the country, they either love him or hate him. But even the ones that don't like him are going to enjoy the economic development.
Sure. Well, Graceland and then Clintonland, you can see both at the same time. Eleanor, stay with us for just a second. Jack, I just wanted to check in with you. You've been listening about all of this, how it looks, and you were also watching the day's events. What was your take on the message of the day?
Well, you know, watching Clinton, I was reminded once more of the gap between his promise and his achievement. His promise, I mean, extraordinary gifts of brain, heart, and tongue. The achievement, well, a good business cycle, balanced budget. But even in the examples he offered today, he talked about the Family and Medical Leave Act, how much that had meant to him. Well, of course, that's unpaid family and medical leave. He talked about welfare reform and how a woman got a job, that she had dignity, yes, but there was a coercive element to that. And, you know, you ask, well, why? Why this gap between promise and achievement? It seems to me in Bush it's just the opposite. There's more achievement for good and ill than there is promise. You ask why, and it seems to me it's because he was really conflict averse. I mean, as people pointed out, this goes way back to his childhood, and it's right there in his politics, which is the synthesis of progressivism and conservatism. He talked about that today, but when you look at his administration, no big fight over the judges who were held up. And of course, now those are vacancies that Bush has filled. No big fight over health insurance, really. I mean, it was a huge deal and a kind of pro forma fight. No even fight with his own party about campaign finance reform. He just let them have one more election. Huge stakes, a kind of pro forma fight. And, you know, the great presidents fight hard. And if they fail, it's usually because they fought too hard. Wilson in 1918, purging his party. FDR in 1937, attacking the court. But with Clinton, no. The gap remains, it seems to me, between great promise and really minimal or moderate achievement.
Well, Jack, hold the thought. We're going to be back after a break for more on that. And Eleanor Cliff, thank you so much for being with us. I understand you've got one more party to go to?
Well, this is a gathering of the tribe. Time to ruminate about what next, and suddenly 2008 seems just around the corner.
Well, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Eleanor Clift is contributing editor for Newsweek magazine, who toured the Clinton Presidential Center and has been attending events in Little Rock all week. We invite you to join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the Clinton legacy. On the day the former president's archives became public, how do you remember the man from Hope? What single achievement do you recall most from the Clinton presidency? And what do you regard as his biggest failure? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. At the dedication today, a number of former presidents spoke. Let's hear some of what Nobel Peace Prize winner Jimmy Carter had to say.
As a governor, as a candidate, and as president, Bill Clinton brought insight, wisdom, and determination to bear on the issues that he addressed. He was a leader who could inspire other people to go beyond what they thought were their own limits to join him in accomplishing great goals.
Well, for more on the events of this day in Little Rock, Arkansas, we're joined in the studio now by Julian Zelizer. He is a professor of history at Boston University. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Julian, let me start with the question about, you know, how huge this place is. I mean, 2 million photographs, 80 million pages of documents, and it's also the first one to deal with scandal, however indirectly. Are you surprised by that, or is that pretty much the way it has to be these days?
It has to be, and especially with President Clinton. I mean, I think one of the things we're going to think about when we remember Bill Clinton is the political environment in which he presided. And that was an environment defined by scandal, politics. It was an environment defined by partisan warfare. So it's fitting that in this library of a president who is virtually impeached, that scandal would be something that he deals with.
But it is telling that for LBJ, comments about the war in Vietnam came later. For the Reagan Library, Iran-Contra added later.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is this is the cynical age. And, you know, President Clinton presided in a very cynical country. And I think a president couldn't get away with it anymore. Having a library that doesn't mention this in the post-90s period, some of the foibles or worse that were part of his administration. So Johnson, yeah, you're right. In his presidential library, there's almost nothing on Vietnam. And I think people would instantly jump on Bill Clinton if he had done that. So it reflects the age we live in.
You are a historian of, among other things, presidential libraries. Now, how is it that we managed to get through life for a couple of hundred years in this country without ever having presidential libraries? Why do we have them now? What purpose does it serve? And is this something that is essential, or is it kind of a vanity project?
Well, the fact we didn't have them until the 1950s, really, 1940s, 50s, reflects this country didn't take government very seriously. We're a country kind of born in a revolution against government, and we're always hesitant to give government too much of a high role in this country. So we never even really thought of presidential papers as something that had to be dealt with seriously until Franklin Roosevelt, who was the first person to establish a presidential library and the first person to say the presidency must be something treasured and remembered in this country. So that's how the library started, and since then we've had them for every president that we've had. They're extremely important. I mean, there's one side which is fun, all the memorabilia and all the displays that you could see at the Clinton Library, and the other half are the papers. These are the documents that record this period in American political history. So if we want questions such as, did we respond to the threats that led to September 11th, in the 1990s, this is one of the best place to look for those kind of answers.
Those answers are somewhere in the papers if you're a presidential scholar and want to go in and look.
They're hopefully somewhere in the papers if it was something recorded, and they're also hopefully going to be released. There's been an ongoing battle in presidential archives over actually releasing the documents that are in there. President Bush in 2003 issued an executive order that allowed presidents and current presidents to veto the release of information in these libraries. And that's going to be a big issue with Clinton's papers.
Jack Beatty, I want to turn to you because this is the way that Clinton wanted his presidential legacy defined. You know, if it's your museum, you get to do it the way you want. But legacies are really not just up to the individual president. Other people get to weigh in, and that can be a little tricky, no?
Oh, indeed. And, you know, when you think about Clinton, his legacy, it seemed to me, his lasting legacy, was in the other party, in the Republican Party. The capture of the House by the Republicans capture, I think, of nearly 50 seats in 1994 was historic. And what with computer-generated gerrymandering and ideological, sort of apartheid in the country, we may never see a Democratic House in our lifetimes. That's an immense achievement. And why did that happen? A political failure on Bill Clinton's part. He didn't manage the politics of health care reform adequately enough. He didn't prioritize it adequately enough. He didn't fight hard enough for it. And secondly, through the impeachment and the Monica Lewinsky thing and so on, he really put the Republican Party into a frenzy of anger from which it hasn't yet to really recover, which seems to me carries it now through elections on this moral issue, on, you know, the Democrats are weak on morality. Yes, that's abortion. Yes, that's other things. But for a lot of people, at least to judge from what I hear on C-SPAN, it's Bill Clinton having an affair, as if somehow having an affair is as grave a moral fault as starting a war that kills thousands of people, an unnecessary war. So I do think that these are tremendous lasting legacies to the other party, and I can't think of a single president in history who's had so positive, so energizing an effect on the opposition.
Let's go to our phone lines now. I want to hear from Paul, who's calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Paul, and welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. And I do agree with what Jack Beatty just said about the tragedies of Bill Clinton's behavior and the effects it had, especially of getting Bush, who barely had a chance to get elected in 2000, getting him elected. But at the same time, the main point I wanted to make was a major benefit of the voters having Bill Clinton in office for six of the 8 years when the Republican Party controlled Congress was that standoff, that opposition, I felt was very important to check at least the Republican Congress. And they were checks on each other. And we know, as Jack Beatty just said, we're paying the penalty for not having that opposition right now, or at least he partly said. Okay, that's basically it. I saw nothing wrong with a do-nothing Congress and gridlock when part of the pundits and so forth were wringing their hands about that. They forced each other to fight things out. He stood up to Newt Gingrich, and at that point, from that point on, They had to make the best of it, of any situation. That's
all right, Paul. Okay, thanks so much for joining us. I want to go to Elaine Kmark now, who is a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and who served in the Clinton White House from 1993 to 1997. Elaine, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Boy, I'm just really eager to hear the answer to this one. What was it like working in the White House, in the Clinton White House?
Oh, it was a wonderful White House to work in. It was very exciting. It was, you know, we had a very charismatic president in President Clinton. We had a very focused and disciplined vice president in Al Gore. And the two of them were, frankly, a marvelous pair. And they really complemented each other. And I think a lot of the success in the first term was due to a real working partnership that was throughout the White House. And it really was a great time, and we really felt that we were building a new Democratic Party.
And yet, you wrote in June, after President Clinton appeared on 60 Minutes in advance of his autobiography coming out, that his attempt to redeem himself and define his own legacy probably would not succeed. Why not?
Well, one of the tragedies I think that a lot of people feel, not everybody says it, but a lot of people feel about the Clinton administration was that it was such a lost opportunity. In the first term, we did a lot of hard things, things that Democrats didn't like. We cut the size of the government. We balanced the budget. We really got the country in a terrific fiscal shape. And the idea was, frankly, that in the second term, we would take on the big issues of the Democratic Party. We would take on the social safety net, Social Security, Medicare, and really fix them and modernize them for the next century. Instead, of course, what happened was that the entire second term was spent in the with the scandal, dominated by the scandal and by impeachment. And instead of Bill Clinton using the political capital he'd built in the first term for great things, he used the political capital, and he had to use every bit of political capital just to save his skin. And I think a lot of people really feel that was a tragedy for the Democratic Party.
Well, do you think he looks better now after 4 years of George Bush?
Well, I think substantively he does, but I think another part of his legacy is, and this was alluded to earlier in the conversation, was that he really seems to have ignited and mobilized and united a religious and moral coalition against the Democratic Party. And we obviously we saw that in 2000. We lost married women in 2000. Clinton was clearly an issue in the 2000 election. I think a lot of people, myself included, had hoped that that would go away in this election, and yet we saw, to a lot of people's surprise, the persistence of this question of moral values in the midst of a shaky economy and a war that wasn't going badly. And I think historically, we may look back and say that one of the Clinton legacies was this very, very, very powerful religious and moral coalition working to the detriment of the Democrats, no matter who they are.
Who do you see as completing his legacy?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, obviously, he hopes that Hillary will complete his legacy. And I think there's a lot of people in the party who do see her as doing that. And that is, in fact, a possibility, although she is very much a lightning rod for some of the same reasons that he was a lightning rod. So I think she has to figure out a way to overcome that. And I think given this election's results, she's got a pretty tough set of problems ahead of her. I think there are other people in the party who are emerging. I think Evan Bayh, who was a governor and also a senator from Indiana, who won by 40 points when Bush was carrying his state by 20 and a Republican was winning the governorship by 20. I think that phenomenon has gotten a lot of people's attention, and people are looking at an Evan Bayh. And you know how it is. There will always be – whoever I say today, I'm sure I'll be dead wrong, and there'll probably be 10 other people I haven't even thought of by 2007.
All right. Well, Elaine, thank you for joining us. If you can stay, please do. If not, thank you again.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Thanks. Elaine K. Mark is a lecturer in public policy at the Kennedy School of Government and served in the Clinton White House from 93 to 97. Julian Zelizer, let me go back to you about this question of legacies and history. We certainly saw in the case of Jimmy Carter that our perception of him changed dramatically. And in fact, if you speak to someone who was there when he was president, the tendency is to remember, well, you know, there were some real problems with the Carter administration. And yet, our view of him changed dramatically after he left office. So if you speak to a younger person who thinks of him post-White House, it's as a statesman, as a Nobel Peace Prize winner. I mean, that's an interesting thing that we can't really say immediately what a president's legacy is going to be, can we?
Absolutely not. I mean, one of the things that is constant is that the legacy and how we remember presidents changes constantly over time. President Carter is a great example in that what he did after the presidency changed the way we thought about him both after and during his presidency. Other presidents have gone through the same thing. Lyndon Johnson during the 1970s was really looked down on, and historians were very critical of Johnson because of Vietnam, because of his failures on social policy. But by the 1980s and 1990s, in the shadow of Ronald Reagan, a lot of historians said Lyndon Johnson looks pretty good. How did he put something together like Medicare now that we know which direction this country could go? So this is going to happen with Bill Clinton. I mean, it will happen even more with Bill Clinton because he was such a polarizing figure. So there's many factors that result in this, but it's an evolving story how we remember our presidents.
Which factor do you think is most important? Do we think of our presidents more kindly once they're gone? Is it that as events unfold, they can either be proven right or wrong in how they looked at the world at the time? Or is it what they do after they leave office?
I don't think it's what they do. That's a short-term phenomenon. I really think it's more about events. History changes our perceptions of history. So 9/11 will forever cause us to reevaluate what President Clinton did for good or bad. And I think that's true with every president.
To Brookline, Massachusetts now, David is on the line. Hi, David.
Hello. I have a few comments and not really a question, but, you know, you mentioned, the historian mentioned Lyndon Johnson. Well, of course, Lyndon Johnson, there's something to identify with him, such as Medicare and other social programs. Jimmy Carter, he won a Nobel Prize for his efforts in the Camp David. Bill Clinton started out on the Middle East issue in 94, when he had Rabin and Arafat at the White House, and yet at the end of his presidency, there was still nothing to show for his many efforts, his intensive efforts on that issue. The only thing I can think of that's positive about Bill Clinton, and I'm speaking as a Democrat, are his appointments to the court and to the federal judiciary, Stephen Breyer and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Other than that, there's not much, and I think the library is a signature of Bill Clinton, always over the top. He came into public view nationally with his keynote address at the 1988 Democratic Convention, and that's what it is. This library is over the top like everything else about Clinton. As far as the Democratic Party is concerned, he had 8 years as the titular head of the party as president, and what's to show for it? Democratic Party is in shambles because of his failure to define it properly. And as far as medical care in this country, medical insurance, he set back the idea of universal medical coverage probably for at least 50 years. I frankly think Bill Clinton was pretty much of a disaster. No one has mentioned the Rwanda issue. 800,000 people were killed by a genocide on his watch, and he had the nerve to go there at the end of his presidency, stand on the doorway of an airplane and apologize for that. I mean, the whole thing is, to me, is just is absolutely ironic. It's
okay.
Doesn't make any sense to me at all.
David, we got it. Thank you so much for the call. In just a couple of moments we have before we have to take a break, Jack Beatty, you know, Clinton certainly is being viewed differently by the Democratic Party these days. At one time he was such a liability, Gore didn't want to campaign with him, but he was greeted like a rock star when he appeared with John Kerry. So what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, he's a great campaigner, and no one has ever doubted that. But, you know, our caller Paul raises a very good point. He was hamstrung in those last years after the Republican. It was a defensive, if the Republican takeover of the Senate and House, it was a defensive battle. But I couldn't agree more with what David just said. I mean, I just think that when you look, you know, you judge presidents by historic achievements. That is, they do something in diplomacy or in legislation that affects the future. It's very hard to see something big like that under Clinton, whereas if we start about Lyndon Johnson, we're going to be here for another 5 minutes talking about those things.
All right, we're going to take a break right now, and then we'll continue our discussion about the legacy of former President Bill Clinton, just 58 years young. So what would you like Clinton to do next? Could his next public role change how he's seen by the American people, as it did for Jimmy Carter? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about leadership and legacies. Have you seen the legacies of Presidents Carter, Reagan, and Kennedy change over time? And what do you think Clinton's legacy will be? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And the current president, George W. Bush, was among those paying tribute to Clinton today in Little Rock. Here is some of what he had to say.
During his presidency, Bill Clinton seized important opportunities on issues from welfare to free trade. He was a tireless champion of peace in the Middle East. He used American power in the Balkans to confront aggression and halt ethnic cleansing. And in all his actions and decisions, the American people sensed a deep empathy for the poor and the powerless. Shortly before leaving office, President Clinton said, "Christ admonished us that our lives will be judged by how we do unto the least of our neighbors." Throughout his career, Bill Clinton has done his best to live up to that standard, and Americans respect him for it.
We're joined in the studio by Julian Zelizer. He's professor of history at Boston University and a presidential scholar. and from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Let me go first back to the phone lines, though, to Raleigh, North Carolina. Kurt is calling. Hi, Kurt. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you.
What's your take on Bill Clinton?
Well, I think President Clinton will be remembered for setting a tone in the American psyche that was really missing in both the previous George Bush and the Reagan years, and also in the present George Bush administration.
How so, Kurt?
In that a president sends a voice, either by code or by words, to the American public, and in that he either energizes or demotivates that American public. With President Clinton, I felt an energy that I have not felt either by the previous administrations for many years or certainly with this president. And for that, I applaud President Clinton, and I feel really good that he was a voice of inclusion and a voice that unified the diversity in this country.
All right, Kurt, thank you so much for the call. And Julian, you echo some of that positive feeling.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to beat up President Clinton about, his personal life, also the failure to achieve many pieces of legislation. But there is something important in the world of ideas. I mean, we have to think of Clinton as the Democrat who was able to defeat the Republicans in an era of Reagan, Bush 1, Bush 2. And he was able to think of a set of ideas that appealed to a broad segment of America that Al Gore has not been able to do and that John Kerry was not able to do. So this mix he did, that he talked about today, of progressivism, of conservatism, of social policies for the middle class, of fiscal conservatism, of targeted foreign policies, yet being restrained overall, is something I think Democrats have to look back on, as now they're searching for a set of ideas that will be able to bring them the White House. I think there's something there that Clinton was able to do that we must take very seriously, and that lies in the world of ideas.
I also want to get back to a point that Eleanor Cliff made earlier in the program, and that was about the amount of money it takes to build one of these presidential libraries and the way in which that happens. It is all private funds, but the Washington Post editorialized today about how money is raised. For example, they pointed out the case of financier Mark Rich, who was pardoned by President Clinton in the waning moments of the administration after his wife wrote a check for $450,000 for the Clinton Library. Now, the Post said these donations should at least be a matter of public record. This one cost $165 million, maybe $180 million was the figure Eleanor mentioned. Should we be more careful about how these things are funded?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, on the one hand, it's good that they're privately funded. I think a lot of people are happy with that. It's one less thing that needs to be taken care of. But on the other hand, there's two big problems. One is these presidents can raise money for the libraries while they're president. So you have conflict of interest potentially with the rich or with other donors who we don't even know about who gave money during the 1990s while Clinton was president. And the second big issue is this issue of disclosure. Unlike other forms of campaign finance, we have no idea who gives the money. And so in this political process, we have to be really cautious. And I think we could keep it as a privately funded system, but we have to impose limitations on when money can be given and understanding who's giving this money.
And Jack, would you agree with that?
Yes, you know, I'm shocked to hear about that. I didn't realize that that this was money that, you give, but you don't have to have any transparency about it. But just to go back to a question that Kurt raised about the tone, this tone of inclusion, I think Toni Morrison addressed that when she said, and many people noticed that she said, Bill Clinton was our first black president. And it took people aback, and she said, no, he connected with African Americans, with minorities. They identified with him, but most of all, they identified with his constant idea of this society is about everybody. It isn't just, you know, for white guys, and it's about everybody, and it's a mosaic. It's not one thing. There are all kinds of groups, and the genius of this country is to get along with one another and to value the diversity. He kept saying that again and again and again. That message, I think, was so important to people on the margins.
To Traverse City, Michigan now. Mike is on the line. And, Mike, we're getting a little close to the end of the program, so I'd appreciate it if you could be brief.
Okay. I think, you know, balancing the budget in this country and keeping us out of a major war is a big thing. See how hard it's been for the president to do.
So you would give Clinton good marks on his legacy?
I would give him great marks. I mean, look what happened. It was less than, what, 2 years, 3 years after he was gone, and we're in a war that's apparently going to last forever, and we're going to have debt that apparently is going to last forever.
All right, Mike, thanks so much for the call. To New York City now, Tom is on the line. Hello, Tom.
Hi, thanks for having me. I wanted to remark on somebody had said earlier on that Clinton didn't fight for things hard enough. And in his first term, what he did, I couldn't agree with Bush, that clip you played a little while ago, more, that what he did for Bosnia. And I remember Rush Limbaugh going on and on about how we were going to be mired in another Vietnam, and the right was really against it, but he followed through and did something from his heart. And also bringing Aristide back to Haiti, certainly the earlier Bush administration, I remember Fitzwater going on about how he had a less than ringing endorsement of Aristide, and yet Clinton, you know, fought to bring Aristide back into Haiti. And now, you know, we don't even hear about Haiti after they got him out of there. And then what he did in Ireland, too. So I think he did fight for a lot of things against what, even though he was criticized for it from the right.
Tom, thanks so much for the call. What about how we're going to look at him in the future? He has been characterized by some, Julian, as a man of great ability but tremendous emotional shortcomings.
Look, that will forever haunt him. And I think the impeachment will be a constant reminder of the emotional and personal shortcomings as we see them. But these are all issues that have to be sorted out. I mean, that's one of the great things about these presidential archives that we're not focusing on. The sunglasses are great. But what's really, really important is that all these issues the callers are discussing, we now have a chance to take a serious look at what the president was able to accomplish and really understand what he couldn't accomplish. Some of those things we don't even know about at this point. But his personal life will forever be part of his presidency, and he can't necessarily blame just other people. And that's part of what presidents have to live with. Everything's on the table and everything's in the history books.
Jack Beatty, I want to give you the last word here. Clinton is a young man. He's 58 and very energetic. How do you think he's going to be viewed 10, 20, 30 years from now, maybe more?
I really think that depends on events. I do think that history changes history in that respect. So that the short answer is we don't know. But two of our callers, Mike and Tom, remind us of the things he did spend political capital on. The balanced budget, my gosh, that's an inglorious cause, but how important it looks now. No foreign war. And then Bosnia. I mean, the Bush administration, Secretary Baker said, we have no dog in that hunt about the civil wars and genocide in former Yugoslavia. Bill Clinton stopped it. And that is a tremendous humanitarian achievement. So There are pluses and minuses, it seems to me, that will be poured over for a long, long time. And as to his personal life, I mean, you know, yes, he had an affair. He shouldn't have done it. This is not one of the graver moral faults in Western man. If it is, then half of our presidents, three-quarters of our politicians are disqualified. And I think one of the things we learned through that impeachment was, frankly, people didn't think that. They didn't think it was such a grave problem. They distinguished between the mistake he made and his competence. They gave him high marks from the competence. And they said, well, he should have behaved better.
Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, thanks so much, as always.
Thank you.
Julian Zelizer, who joined us in the studio, professor of history at Boston University. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Earlier in the program, we spoke with Elaine Kmark, a lecturer in public policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and to Eleanor Clift, contributing editor for Newsweek magazine. We invite you to continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org. And we end this hour tonight with words from the man of the hour, former President Bill Clinton. At the close of the dedication of his library today, the former president went to the podium in the pouring rain to thank everyone who had made the day possible and to do his best to characterize his legacy. And then the former president made a remarkable call for unity in a country now famously divided along red and blue lines.
The thing I want most is for people to come to this library, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, liberals or conservatives, to see that public service is noble and important, that the choices and decisions leaders make affect the lives of billions of Americans and people all across the world. I want young people to want to see not only what I did with my life, but to see what they could do with their lives. Because this is mostly the story of what we the people can do when we work together. Yes, this library is the symbol of a bridge to the 21st century. It's been called one of the great achievements of the new age, and the British magazine said it looked like a glorified house trailer. And I thought, well, that's about me. You know, I'm a little red and a little blue. What it is to me is the symbol of not only what I tried to do, but what I want to do with the rest of my life. Building bridges from yesterday to tomorrow, building bridges across racial and religious and ethnic and income and political divides, building bridges. I believe our mission in this new century is clear. For good or ill, we live in an interdependent world. We can't escape each other. And while we have to fight our enemies, we can't possibly kill, jail, or occupy all of them. Therefore, we have to spend our lives trying to build a global community and an American community of shared responsibilities, shared values, shared benefits. What are those values? And I want to say this. This is important. I don't want to be too political here, but it bothers me when America gets as divided as it was. I once said to a friend of mine about 3 days before the election, and I heard all these terrible things. I said, you know, am I the only person in the entire United States of America who likes both George W. Bush and John Kerry? Who believes they're both good people, who believe they both love our country and they just see the world differently? What should our shared values be? Everybody counts. Everybody deserves a chance. Everybody's got a responsibility to fulfill. We all do better when we work together. Our differences do matter, but our common humanity matters more. So I tell you, we can continue building our bridge to tomorrow. It will require some red American line drawing and some blue American barrier breaking. But we can do it together.
Former President Bill Clinton speaking at the dedication of his library in Little Rock, Arkansas, earlier today. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.